Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is sensory disorders. For years, teachers and therapists have noticed that some children find it extremely painful to brush their hair or to have a tag on their shirts. Other children seem to be in a fog, always a step behind their peers, a little off. In the 1950s, Dr. A. Jean Ayers, an occupational therapist and educational psychologist, decided to try to understand these out-of-sync children. The result was her theory of sensory integration dysfunction. It describes a traffic jam in the brain in the face of sensory input. Since then, a growing number of occupational therapists, neuropsychologists, and developmental psychologists have embraced this theory, not waiting for it to be accepted fully by science. Their diagnostic methods for what is now called sensory processing disorder can seem imprecise, and their treatments are often unorthodox. Skeptics complain that these treatments are not supported by data. Even so, there are passionate advocates among some parents, educators, and therapists. They feel the treatments work and are not waiting for the data to catch up. This July, the debate heated up as UCSF released a study that used brain imaging to show physiological differences in children with sensory processing disorder. We have with us tonight in studio three Bay Area professionals working on sensory issues. First, we have Julia Wilberger. Julia received a PhD in developmental psychology with an emphasis on developmental cognitive neuroscience from the University of Denver. She and her mother, Patricia, developed one of the most widely used treatments for sensory issues, the Wilberger TheraPressure Program. They also run the Avanti workshops on sensory defensiveness and designed an overnight camp for children with sensory processing disorder. Julia is currently an associate professor of occupational therapy at Dominican University in San Rafael. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you.
Also joining us in studio is Patty Otter. Patty is an occupational therapist and private consultant on sensory issues based in San Ramon. Known for innovative treatments for sensory disorders, Patty has co-authored books and articles and clinical training relating to the treatment, including Out of the Mouths of Babes. She has also worked directly with A. Jean Ayers and a select group of clinicians to develop coursework on sensory integration. Welcome, Patty.
Thank you.
And finally, we are joined by Cassie Britton. Cassie is a child development specialist and program director at the Little School and co-founder of Sensory Social Playgroups. Additionally, she provides consulting and in-home support services. She graduated from Cornell University with a degree in child development and family studies. Welcome, Cassie.
Hi, thanks, David.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. While we very much want to hear from you, I will remind you that our panel is unable to diagnose anyone on air. Do you know a child with sensory issues? Do you have an experience, positive or negative, with treatment for sensory issues? Do you have a question for our panel? We would like to hear from you. Julia, let's start with you. Give us the big picture here. What exactly is sensory processing disorder?
Well, one of the first things to kind of get over with sensory processing disorders is they're not just one thing. It is actually a cluster of disorders. The main crux of thinking, the big definition or the big picture of sensory processing disorders is that the normal input that goes into our brains day after day, all moment to moment, that helps us organize our behavior, help us coordinate our movements, help us keep our thinking straight, our attention right, our levels of being alert just right, go into these kids with sensory processing disorders, and they don't come back out in the same way. They don't assist them in these different areas of their life. And we think of several different ways in which this disorganization kind of manifests itself or looks out in the world. Is we have disorganization of motor skills, and that's one class of kids. Another class of kids whose perceptual abilities don't seem to be working correct. And another set of kids who we think of, and we describe them as having sensory modulation issues, is that the sensation in the environment disorganizes their attention, their activity level, and their alertness. One category that I know that we really want to get to tonight is talking about sensory defensiveness. And that is an unusual category around sensory modulation issues. And that is when individuals have what we call a really unusual or negative response to sensation, that shouldn't bother them. So when you, in your introduction, talked about kids who hate having their hair brushed, these are kids who feel like almost their life is threatened when they get their hair brushed. The tags in the back of their clothes are like spiders crawling on their backs, and they respond in those same fearful and anxious ways.
Patty Otter, could you describe some other behaviors that are typical for children battling with this at school and at home? What are the types of things you would see with a child with a sensory disorder?
Well, I think the first thing is what Julie was just talking about, and that is that they have unusual responses to sensory motor events that are occurring around them. They have a larger, what do I want to say, a larger response. So it could be aversion, it could be withdrawal, it could be a meltdown. They have trouble with transitions, they have trouble in groups where the kids are too close together and unpredictably moving around. They sometimes are really bossy and controlling, so they have trouble with their peers. They might not be able to use the playground equipment because they're fearful of heights or fearful of getting bumped into or, you know, those kinds of things.
And Cassie Britton, do these types of disorders usually occur on their own or in concert with other problems that the child may be dealing with?
Well, I think that they generate a good range of consequences. So if a child has a strong fight or flight reaction to unexpected touch, for instance, in a classroom, then they might be very hypervigilant and then they avoid certain situations where they would be learning to fluidly play with friends. And so they might become a step behind in being able to navigate group play. Or they might lose their sense of confidence in being able to try new things. Or, as Patty brought up, if they're having difficulty transitioning, that's a time when teachers are working extra hard to keep things going smoothly. And if a child is having trouble, then often the child will pick up that they are failing in some way. And then they might become even more resistant because they don't feel understood, and they feel like they're the bad kid. So I think there's a whole host of issues that can come out of it, just as a spinoff from a sensory processing challenge.
And how early could a child be diagnosed, and what is the age range that you have seen in your own practice of young people dealing with these issues?
Well, you know, at the preschool that I've been working with for a long time, we have definitely been able to generate conversation with parents and help kids get to a good OT at 3 or 4 years old. But I think that would actually be a good question to ask Patty.
Patty, go ahead.
It's been my experience, and Julie can probably address this as well, that very often within the first few days of life, parents are worried about their kids being extraordinarily irritable, very difficult to calm, that they don't sleep, that eating, you know, is an issue. So sometimes, you know, we will hear even from, you know, if kids don't get to us until later, that they were crying 20 out of 24 hours a day for months.
And Julia, let me turn to you. What are the causes of this kind of, you've described some pretty severe behaviors?
Let me go back to just back up a little bit to answer that idea of do we see sensory processing disorders and some of these things associated with other disorders? And
there Please do.
And it is very common to see sensory processing disorders in other disorders like the autism spectrum disorders, to some extent, attention deficit disorders. There's a couple of kinds of genetic-based disorders in which sensory processing disorders are very, very common. And so one of the causes may be due to just developmental or neurodevelopmental issues. The research has shown also, though, that there is a genetic link in sensory processing disorders. So identical twins are more likely to have co-occurrences of sensory processing disorders than non-identical twins. It's more likely when there is family members who have particularly sensory modulation or sensory defensiveness to have children or their very own siblings that have sensory processing disorders. We also see children or individuals who have had a really rough early history, prenatal exposure to drug and alcohol, postnatal neglect, or children who were born in institutions and didn't get a consistent care. So we see that there's genetic factors, there's environmental factors that all can potentially contribute to sensory processing disorders.
And this is really a question for all of you, but Patty, let me start with you. Why has the medical community been slow to fully embrace this going forward?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know. I think that, with the experience that I have had with various and sundry pediatricians, for instance, or even at the university when, I was doing some slots in their pediatric lectures, they think higher. So they think more about higher brain function, I think, and they're taught pretty much to look at things from a behavioral perspective or a brain damage perspective. And I think it's harder for them to understand how incredibly important those lower structures of the brain are for regulation. And they tend to go at the symptoms rather than the causes. That's my best guess.
Cassie, what's your sense of that?
Well, I think it's interesting because having worked with children in the Bay Area for so long, I have found that if we have referred children, for instance, to a developmental pediatrician at California Pacific Medical Center, we have certainly had medical professionals who have recognized it and sent the children to occupational therapists who have a sensory integration perspective, and we've seen great progress. We've seen children referred to different places, including the school district, and the frame is a much different understanding. So I actually think there's some variability in the field as well.
Yeah, I have certainly worked with a number of pediatricians who are very open to the idea. And for a while, I thought it might be an age thing, because at first it was the older pediatricians that were doing more of a general practice thing that really got it. But now I don't think that's the case anymore. I don't know why. But there are several really good pediatricians and developmental pediatricians. You just have to figure out
who they are
and where they're hiding out.
And Julia, you're a second generation fighting this battle. Have things changed over time?
I think so. And I think one of the primary reasons why this area has not been recognized is because it's come primarily out of occupational therapy. And at the heart, we're practitioners, we're clinicians. Mm-hmm. We would rather be barefoot and playing with kids in the clinic than being stuck in a stuffy old lab doing research. And so there's very few of us who are PhD-trained researchers who are out there doing that research.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last decade, we've had some really amazing people. Mary Schneider at the University of Wisconsin, Grace Baranek at University of North Carolina, Roseanne Schaff at Temple University, Patty Davies at Colorado State University. These are pioneering OTs who are doing hardcore research, who are doing primate studies, other neurological studies using EEG, using physiological measures, who are really validating it. But it's really been in the last decade where we've had OTs who really understand sensory processing issues, doing the primary research, using really good hardcore techniques.
It's my understanding as well that brain imaging technology has grown enormously as well, and that has bore out a lot of Jean Ayres' theories.
Sure. And how important is the UCSF study, Julia, that just came out in terms of field acceptance of this work?
Well, I think it's an important link. And I think also where it's coming from, that it is also non-OT researchers with OT collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a new methodology. Nobody has used the tensor imaging before. And so it is an interesting thing. It gets at white matter. It gets at something different than maybe Mary Schneider has used positron emission technology to tomography to look at primates. So now it's adding a really important link into our understanding of what are possible neurological mechanisms.
How common is this problem? Is there a sense of what percentage of young people are afflicted by one of these disorders?
Well, I think that The best guess is somewhere between 10% and 15%, and I've seen people bandy around a little bit higher for developmental disorders. So people will estimate within autism somewhere between 75% and 90% in autism. So I think it depends, but I think somewhere around 10% is probably a very safe bet.
And how many of these children are actually diagnosed versus those who are just continuing to struggle without being connected to professionals who can possibly help them?
I wish I knew. You know, for me also, I think that the framework of understanding sensory integration dysfunction comes along with an understanding of what sensory integration is for learning and how we all have sensory profiles. And I think it's a very useful tool for teachers and practitioners to just understand what kinds of sensory regulatory strategies we all use and what kinds of ways we process information and how we all need different kinds of things to help stay regulated and to help stay alert. So to me, the benefits of knowing it allows me to help children who may not even qualify as having sensory processing disorder but might need some help along the way in, you know, with different levels of challenge. So to me, you know, there's probably lots of kids who need the help, and then there's lots of kids who can just use the understanding in a developmental way.
Can you give a quick example of just a typical client that you see, a typical child, what types of issues they would have and how they would get referred to you in the first place?
Well, a lot of the children who come to the sensory social play groups that I run with my partner, Fiona Zecca, have had a difficult time at school either making friends and sustaining friendships and relationships, social relationships. They are probably having a bumpy time at school either focusing and concentrating. Transitioning is often an issue. Sometimes we have children who just aren't connecting and having a back and forth flow because they are, as you put it at the beginning, kind of in a fog. They're under responsive. So we will have children who have a real variety of issues coming to this in a different way, but they will often have their teachers have noticed something, or their parents have noticed something, or the developmental pediatrician recommends us, or an OT recommends us, or a psychologist, or a neuropsych.
Patty, how often are these disorders confused with similar disorders that might have similar symptoms? How do you pull out that this is actually what's occurring?
That's also a very good question. You know, there's so many disciplines that look at child development, behavior, learning, memory, communication, all those things, and we all have different LMNOPs after our name. And somehow or other, we all have a different language. So that I don't think that it's a separation of diagnoses as much as it is the way we each look at a piece of development. We're looking through different windows, if you will. And then we call it something. So, you know, the sensory processing things go along with a lot of other issues, or you could lay the symptoms out and one discipline will call it one thing and another discipline might call it something else.
And Julia, what's your sense of confusion over what may actually be at the cause of some of these things?
Well, I do think that there are there is a lot of overlap in the behaviors, but I think as we start to look underneath what's going on and we look at some of the core pieces of this, we're going to see there being very distinct kinds of separation. So let's take sensory defensiveness, for example. That's a very narrow kind of sensory processing disorder. And you have in there some behaviors that are really unique to it and you don't see in other kinds of behaviors. And that is that those negative, really fearful driven responses to normal sensation. They act as if they're being hurt or terrified by things that are just normal in their environment that some people don't even notice. And we think about that their whole nervous system is just really in this state of alarm. They are in a war zone. They are in a dark parking lot. They are in this state of fear where everything is out there for them to notice and to be sensitive about and to defend against. And that is very different than a child who has ADHD who may be bouncing around and not paying attention to something. Something with a child with sensory defensiveness may not be paying attention to things, but they're studying their environment. They're looking everywhere. They're vigilant to everything that's happening out there, and they're completely on edge, whereas ADHD may be like, oh, well, there's a purple crayon. Oh, I want the blue one now, and where's that bird outside? You know, their inattention has a very, very different quality than that.
So a trained eye, that's easy to discern those differences.
Yes.
Okay.
I think there's also depending on which discipline it is and what kind of information they have. Some of my favorite psychologists and neuropsych people know how to do a good interview, and when they're doing a really good solid developmental interview, they know to bring up the responsivity to typical sensory events or sensory motor behavior.
Okay, I'm going to ask in a moment about what the actual treatment methods are, which I think our listeners will be very interested in. But first, we're going to pause for a moment to ask for your support for KLW and programs like City Visions.
Thank you. Thank you, David. You are tuned to KLW, your local public radio. And we bring you shows like City Visions because we are locally based. And, of course, being locally based means we need your support to keep KLW strong and making shows like City Visions possible. I'm here with Joseph Pache, a host of City Visions that you hear on a regular basis. Good evening, Joseph. There we go. Helps if I have your mic on.
So you can call 1-800-525-9917 or go online at klw.org to make your pledge of support.
That's how you know it's live radio.
That's right. 800-525-9917 or klw.org to support programs like City Visions, which is just one of many locally produced public affairs programs that KLW brings you, a mix that is unique to this station. 1-800-525-9917.
Or you can just log on at klw.org, the same place you are right now as you're typing up a question or a response or wanting to contribute to City Visions. And I believe that that address is
1-800-KLW.org, you mean?
No, or, how do they?
Oh, feedback at cityvisionsradio.com.
Feedback at cityvisions.com.
But first, I want them to go to klw.org to do a pledge, and then
they can join the show.
Then comment.
That's right. We have a very modest goal. We just need clicks and calls. Clicks and calls is all we need this hour. A small goal of $1,000 is what we would really like in this 1 hour show. So please join us. Become a member of KALW, your local public radio, by calling 1-800-525-9917 or kalw.org. And now let's go back to your host, David Onick.
This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight on City Visions, we're discussing sensory disorders with our guests, Julia Wilbarger, Associate Professor of Occupational Therapy at Dominican University and creator of the Wilbarger Brushing Protocol, Patty Otter, an occupational therapist and private consultant specializing in sensory defensiveness, and Cassie Britton, child development specialist at the Little School in San Francisco and co-head of Sensory Social Playgroups. We invite you to call in now with your questions or comments. Again, I do need to remind you that our panel cannot diagnose anyone on the air. But do you know a child who has been treated for sensory issues? Do you feel you yourself have suffered from sensory integration issues? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. Okay, now we're going to get to the fun stuff. Let's talk about the treatments for this condition. And Julia, I'd like to start with you. What is the sensory diet? What is it and how does it help young people?
Well, the sensory diet was based on the concept of just like your nutritional needs, you have daily sensory needs. We all need some interaction with sensation in the environment. Sometimes it's just a brisk walk, sometimes it's just a wiggle, sometimes it's, you know, like a chew on your pen. But for somebody who has a sensory processing disorder, it's like somebody who has like a nutritional metabolic disorder. You have to have a special diet. Kids who have sensory issues need to have sensation presented to them in an organized way that their nervous system can use to better their ability to interact with the environment. So we do, I can send it off to Patty to talk about what some of the funner things are. But it's like having programs that we can give a child to do that has a sensory motor component, a little physical activity first thing in the morning. We might have them have certain things that they might chew on or drink or suck on for breakfast to get their mouths woken up. We might have things that repeat throughout the day. We might have bigger things in which we're really doing a lot more physical activity. We're capitalizing on the fact that working your muscles hard, moving a lot, using that inner ear sense, that vestibular sense, helps contribute to this overall organization and integration. So we may have more what we think of as meal-type exercises throughout the day, and then have other little sensory kinds of breaks or what we make sensory snacks. So it's really that idea that we really need to have an organized, enriched sensory environment or sensory activity throughout the day when somebody has a sensory processing disorder.
Your mother is known for creating the Wilbarger TheraPressure program, which is often called the brushing protocol. Can you explain what this involves and how she came up with it?
Well, it involves actually, it's a deep pressure massage technique at the heart of it. It happens to use a brush that allows you to provide very deep, even pressure. So it's the evenness is why you would want to use the brush. It's a protocol that you repeat every couple of hours. You do it for a very distinct period of time. And this is a technique that should only be used for individuals who have sensory defensiveness. And the brushing protocol gets used for all kinds of things in the world, but is really designed for decreasing sensory defensiveness.
So are you saying it's being used for some things that maybe it shouldn't be used for?
It's used for a lot of things that it shouldn't be used for. Oftentimes people will use it to try and improve attention in children who have attention issues. It may or may not have success for helping somebody calm down. If you had a nice little massage first thing every morning, you might be a happier person. So the principles of how it works are not that much different than the principles related to massage, but we do it in such consistent increments that it has more of a cumulative effect. Patricia Wilbarger came up with this really based on understanding the neurophysiology of touch and how powerful it was for creating this internal sense of modulation and comfort. There's a huge literature on the power of touch and how it affects our basic physiology. She's also been one who has thought of therapeutic use of sensation is really needing to be done in the context of intensity, that this frequency. She also coined the term sensory diet. And so she has always been about, okay, if you can make a difference in a child's life in a one-hour treatment session once a week, why not give them a therapeutic experience 7 days a week, 24 hours, and do things in an intensive way? So her idea was, well, okay, if a little bit of tactile input helps reduce that, or deep pressure tactile input reduces some of that sensory defensiveness, well, what if you did it very, very frequently, intensively? Could you do this for a short period of time and then really decrease permanently that sensory processing? And she turned out to be right.
And what is that period of time that a young person would go through this therapy for?
Well, the true answer is as long as it takes. But we generally see some period of time that may be as short as 3 or 4 weeks and could be as long as maybe 6 to 8 weeks. If you get out much longer than 6 to 8 weeks, it really takes it takes some really decision making whether to go on. But the reality is that it looks like an extremely simple thing to do, but the clinical reasoning it takes to decide how long, how frequently, when to start, when to stop, takes a professional level, and it takes advanced training, and it takes a strong background in sensory integration, and it takes advanced training in the specific technique itself to do. So it looks really simple, but underneath it has got a lot of complex pieces to it.
Cassie, you had a follow-up.
Yeah, you know, I remember the first child that I ever had at the preschool I've been working with for 26 years, and so this was a long time ago. And he was a little boy who was just had so much anxiety in a preschool classroom, was clutching two Thomas the Tank Engines, one in each hand, not touching anybody, kind of on the edges of the classroom. Really a struggle to see him come to school daily. And when his OT prescribed the brushing protocol and the parents, it's quite a commitment, actually, to pull off. And then the teachers were taught how to do it. You know, I don't remember exactly what the time period was, but the transformation was pretty amazing to see this child just relax and be able to take risks and let go of the tank engines and start touching and engaging and being a part of the classroom. It was pretty compelling and pretty convincing to me as a young teacher.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing sensory disorders with our guests, Julia Wilbarger, Associate Professor of Occupational Therapy at Dominican University and creator of the Wilbarger Brushing Protocol that we were just discussing, Patty Otter, an occupational therapist and private consultant specializing in sensory defensiveness, Cassie Britton, a child development specialist at the Little School in San Francisco and co-head of sensory social playgroups. We invite you to call in now with your questions and comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. Let's go to the phones now, and we have Laura from San Francisco. Laura, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I have a young son who is just starting kindergarten, and we have been doing OT and speech since he was really small. He's at the Italian immersion school, and they found that that he had sensory processing issues when he was about two. And one thing that's been recommended is to do cranial sacral therapy as well as neurofeedback. We've been doing cranial sacral therapy, and it's helped him eat because eating was a big issue with him. But I'm very nervous about the neuro feedback, and I didn't know if you had any information on that.
Patty, would you like to take that one?
Well, I know about the cranial sacral therapy. I do that, so and I know how powerful that can be. How old is he now?
He just turned six.
Well, tell us some about the cranial sacral therapy, and tell us, I know that's something that's a standard treatment that you're involved with. Can you
right.
describe in more detail what that is?
Cranial sacral therapy is one of the body therapies. It's an energy technique, if you will. And it's really a matter of using the power of touch, actually, and kind of being with, if you will, a person's body, their energy, and the places that things are not moving well. Part of the things that I do as an OT are to look for those places where muscles in the connective tissue are not moving smoothly. One of the huge things for our kids with defensiveness, and that being a modulation disorder, is that these kids have a really hard time getting a rhythmic suck, rhythmic breathing, that kind of thing going. So I go more at it from that end. So a lot of times there's some oral motor structural things. I will go at it that way. And a lot of times just a basic cranial sacral treatment is extremely organizing for kids.
Laura, thank you for your call. Let's go to line two. And Cash on line two, you have a question for our guests.
Yeah, this is Cash. I'm calling from San Francisco. So I have a child who's 7 years old, has severe fears and anxiety, and it represents itself in sometimes having trouble breathing and you can, and some nights he will wake up and have just general fears about all the things that are going wrong. And I was curious what might be some just coping strategies for us as parents, because certainly we don't like seeing him constantly in fear. And I'll take the answer offline.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Of course, we can't diagnose based on the information we have here.
But
if you had a parent come to you in your practice and say this about a child, what's the first thing you would ask them, or what would be the next step?
The next step would be to do a real thorough sensory history and a good developmental history, and that can be done by an OT that has expertise in that area. Or if you get to a good neuropsych or good developmental psychologist that are asking those questions, that might steer you in the right direction.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. One issue is, I know that these disorders are not in the DSM, are not in the guidebook for disorders, and so treatments have to be paid out of pocket. What does that mean for families that do not have the means to pay for these treatments, given that it's very hard to get insurance to pay for them? Yes, Patty.
I am an occupational therapist, and so I'm looking at child development in a much broader scope. And most of the times the kids, you know, come with sensory defensiveness being a part of a general postural or motor issue. So they are covered by insurance to be treating, you know, to be treating that. So that that allows a lot more families access to therapies. The other thing is there are a number of people who some groups that will do scholarships for kids to be able to get treatment. Am I talking about the DSM?
There was a really strong concerted effort to get sensory processing disorders into the DSM and
the new revision
and it just, I believe that the committee just came to the conclusion that while there was a growing, mounting amount of evidence that was available there, that it just wasn't really crossing the bar as of yet. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be there sometime in the future. And I think back on, I sort of have a longer view now, is that Dr. Ehrers really made some of her original proposals around sensory integrative disorders in the early 1960s. And here we are, 2013. We're talking about 50 years of something, you know, hanging around. This is, you know, this is not just like a fad. There's a lot of fad diagnosis and treatment things that have come and gone, and this has been something that's persisted. And it's persisted because we've had really consumer demand for it, and people recognize it. So, you know, we're going to be around, and the next time they revise the DSM, there's a small army of us who are providing research who will hopefully will shift some of that perspective, the committee's perceptions, and we'll end up in the DSM.
Was that UCSF study out yet when those discussions were happening?
No.
So the research is moving forward, and it may well be in the next revision that more progress is made.
Yeah, and there's three or four other studies that are out there that are in the process of being reviewed for publication. I have three studies that are out there that are in review and revision for publication that look at the underlying physiology around sensory defensiveness and look at comparing the physiological responses of people without sensory defensiveness to people with sensory defensiveness. And so it will just continue to work, and the evidence will continue to mount.
Cassie, with the parents that you work with, when you're working with their children, how much do they want to see peer-reviewed studies on this versus just seeing that their child is getting better? How much do parents care about the research when they're struggling to find a solution for their child?
Well, I think there's a range in different styles of parents are looking for different kinds of feedback from specialists. But generally, the people who are coming to bring their children to the playgroup really are just looking for professionals who take in the information about their concrete lives, understand their children and their challenges and then help come up with strategies that make them more successful. So they're not really spending a whole lot of time thinking about what is the research. Their child is their research project, and they're happy if things get better for them.
We're going to take another opportunity now for you to become a KALW member.
Thank you, Mr. Onik. This is Eric Wayne with your local public radio, KALW, right here in San Francisco. And I'm here with Joseph Pache. We're just going to take just a few minutes to remind you that we are in the middle of our membership campaign. And I know that our guest tonight cannot make a diagnosis, but I'm going to make a diagnosis tonight, right now. I'm sure that there's someone out there who wants to know how they can become involved. How can they contribute keeping their local public radio strong? And there's a very easy cure for that.
It's calling 1-800-525-9917 or going to KALW.org to make a pledge. I'm Joseph Pache, and it's interesting that we're talking about sensory disorders this evening and how they didn't make it into the latest edition of the DSM. And we had some of the people who contributed to the DSM just on the air with us last week, just showing you how we are connected to the cutting edge of the conversation, whether it be about science, the environment, the arts, or politics here on City Visions and generally here at KALW. So show your support and join your fellow listeners in keeping local public radio mighty and strong by dialing 1-800-525-9917 or going to KALW.org.
And City Visions is about the city you live in. It's all about you, and you can help keep City Visions strong. You can help keep your local public radio strong. Just become a member. That's all there is to it. Go to KALW.org, or you can call 1-800-525-9917. And now let's go back to City Visions on your local public radio.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're also on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing sensory disorders with a terrific guest, Julia Wilbarger, Associate Professor of Occupational Therapy at Dominican University, Patty Otter, an occupational therapist and private consultant specializing in sensory defensiveness, and Cassie Britton, child development specialist at the Little School in San Francisco and co-head of Sensory Social Playgroups. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have a child who's been treated for sensory issues? Do you feel that you yourself has suffered from sensory issues? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Let's go to the phones now. We have Sarah on the line. Sarah, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I have a 10-year-old daughter who has high modulation regulation issues on the hyper end of the scale. Late in the summer, we started her on a sensory diet, as you will, including brushing, music, body work, breathing exercises, and we've seen grand improvement. However, there's not to say there are days where there's tremendous setbacks as well. And I'm just curious, you know, when you have a protocol, is it something that you think of in terms of 6 to 8 week segments, a month, 2 month segment, and then you change, stop because you've seen improvement, and then you come back to it a year later? What's the timeline for sort of a sensory diet, especially as the kids get older?
Oh, I think this is Julia. We think there's, you know, there's things go in phases and things go in kind of waves. Oftentimes, we begin some of these treatment programs with a lot of intensive work. And then we often have kind of a rhythm in our work where we might back off for a little while. The sensory diet is there, but it's not quite as intensive. It may be thinking of it as that we do some more things that are kind of maintenance. We let the developmental changes kind of settle in, let a child kind of find their place to like sort of grow within the new context of this little bit more organized nervous system. But it absolutely varies for every single child on this planet, and no child who I have ever treated has had the same pathway or the same predictable course. It is always taking that moment-to-moment reasoning, really looking at each child and what are their personal strengths and weaknesses. What is the family strength and weaknesses? How long can a family keep up intensive treatment programs before you're just going a little bit crazy with it? So every single family, every single child is really going to have a different program based on their individual needs.
Can I follow up on that last mm-hmm. point? Because as a parent, some of these protocols are pretty extensive, right? And so I think you raise a very important issue that part of it has to be how much can the family consistently continue the intensity of some of these treatments? Because if they're not going to do them, it seems to me it doesn't make sense if they're going to do them inconsistently. Would I be right about that?
Darren, you're absolutely correct, is that when these programs work the best is when there's really considerable, really good consistency. And I think that's part of being a good clinician is to really be able to work with the families and figure out what is the best treatment approach that's for this family. And time, tolerance, resources, you know, is really, all those things are really important to consider.
You know, I'd have to piggyback and say that I also think that for a lot of these children, being able to have some kind of curriculum frame of understanding themselves and, like, there's a great program called the Zones of Regulation that we use in Playgroup, and it's really about helping the children develop the ability to understand their own regulation patterns, the things that are difficult for them, their triggers, and to just have a comfortable sense that it's okay to have some things be tricky and that there are things you can do to manage it. And so, you know, a lot of the children, I think, go through periods where they feel very much on top of things and then they have setbacks. And, you know, sometimes it can just be a growth spurt. Sometimes it's the holidays and their whole schedule has changed, or vacation time is often an extra bumpy time. And I think that not only do we look at it just from a treatment viewpoint and trying to get the children the right treatment, but also helping the family come up with tools and the school come up with tools to help the child navigate the ups and downs.
I think there's another point in here too, and that is that when we do these intensive protocols, things change quite rapidly. One of the things that clinicians struggle with is to try and figure out how to support a child through that process, because there is always disorganization as the brain is trying to get itself regrouped around a new concept, a new way to be, a new way to feel, that kind of thing. So you get these periods of disorganization, and then poof, you get a big reorganization slam. So some days are really hard, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get this big leap. I've had kids that a couple of them. One said to me one time, "The fog has finally lifted." And another kid that says, when I was asking him how he was doing, "I don't have to be so vigilant anymore," which just says, okay, we're on the right track. And parents work so hard. It's really, really difficult. The commitment, you know, that we get from families is astounding.
Great. Let's now go to an email from Christy in Minneapolis. Christy asks, can your panelists comment on what is being done in the OT field to educate practitioners and parents in how to use nutrition to help with sensory defensiveness? I'd love their thoughts, experiences on how food, nutrition, and diet affect sensory defensiveness and what they might recommend.
There are a number of therapists that are very closely linked with issues around metabolic problems. And most of us at least have enough understanding to help families get to the right people to have those things checked out. There's such a big push right now around gluten-free, casein-free. We know that both of those things will include different kinds of responses to sensation. We also know that there are lacks in some of the minerals that can put a person in a place where they would have more defensive behaviors than typical.
Terrific. Let's go back to the phones. We have Jeannie from Berkeley. Jeannie, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. It's so delightful that y'all are talking about this. Thanks so much. My question is that my son is 7 and was diagnosed with sensory seeking disorder, and I'm not sure how that sounds like, doesn't sound too much like sensory defensiveness. Are the things you're talking about would treat the sensory seeking?
Well, in one classification of the sensory processing disorders, there's a way of sort of slicing up the pie in terms of talking about over-responsivity, then under-responsivity, and sensory seeking. And sensory seeking is sometimes a challenging concept to create is around potentially a diagnosis, because there's a lot of reasons why somebody might potentially sensory seek. We tend to think of people who seek out a lot of sensation as potentially being the opposite of somebody who avoids sensation. But we also have the situation where sensory seeking could be as a way of getting some kind of self-treatment, of getting the sensation that one needs to get themselves organized. There's also people who just tend to need more sensation because of other things that are going on with them. They may seem like they are actually under-responding to things in their world, and they need more to get themselves out of it. So sensation seeking is a tricky classification. And you kind of also put on that we all have a certain sensation seeking need. You know, if I'm starting to nod off on, you know, and I'm sitting in somebody's research talk and I'm starting to nod off, I'm going to go and I'm going to dig into my purse and see if I can find gum or something to chew on, or I'm going to start wiggling my legs. So we use sensation seeking as a way of creating our own internal adaptation. So in and of itself, sensory seeking is a very, very tricky classification. And I think that the secret of that is to find out what's underneath that sensory seeking. What is the reason that's helped getting somebody who to seek out more sensation, presumably to have better adaptation to something.
And the developmental psychologist or pediatrician would be able to do that kind of analysis, you think?
A developmental pediatrician or a neuropsychologist or a psychologist would not be able to do that unless they have had training in sensory integration and sensory processing disorders. I know a couple in the world who do have that level of training, but they're very few and far between.
We have time. Thank you very much for your call. We have time for one last call from Eric in San Francisco. Eric, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks. I wanted to just tell the experience of my son that I think might give people some hope, but it also... what happened was we have a son who clearly had some of these issues as a young child, and we found that knowing about it was tremendously helpful to us as parents, to know that he had some issues that we needed to be aware of. We tried the brushing, we tried swinging, we tried bouncing, we tried lots of things. And I honestly would say that he just kind of outgrew it. And so I think that when parents are panicked about this, they should be aware that kids will sort of work through this as they get older, and it's not always necessary to have some massive intervention.
Eric, thank you very much for your call. Patty, go ahead, please.
I'm so glad that worked out for you. You know, most of the children that come to see me sound like they were in, you know, having a lot more issues than what you're describing. So I'm not sure I would want to wait to see if they grow out of it. If it's affecting the way they can interact with at home, the way they interact at school, their ability to make friends and be happy about their life, then, you know, then maybe not, then just watch for it. But if it's affecting those kinds of areas, I would say please seek out some help.
Okay, we just have a couple minutes left. And in terms of seeking out help, for listeners who are drawn in by this, who want to learn more, I'd love to hear from each of you where you would recommend they go. Are there websites? Are there books? Are there studies? Let's start with you, Julia. Where would you recommend for our listeners to go to get more information?
Well, I think the first line is to probably find a clinician who's able to really direct the specific information to them.
And where could they find a clinician?
I was going to say that here in the Bay Area, there is an association of pediatric therapists. It is an association of both occupational therapists and physical therapists that is a collective organization that may be able to help people find local area therapists in the Bay Area specifically.
And Cassie, what about you? How could people connect with the work that you do and people like you?
Well, you know, I think the web's a very powerful place these days, and most of the parents will find the playgroup on the web, or they will, been recommended by different professionals. But I do think that there are some good resources for parents to read out there, and I think that going and looking up southpaw.com, it's an amazing OT retailer that sells amazing equipment and play equipment, and they also sell books and resources. I am part of the DIR practitioners, people who do floor time, which is another kind of therapy model that uses occupational therapy kinds of thinking. And I think there's a lot of good information there, particularly for children who might be on the autistic spectrum.
Patty, a quick last word.
There's a number of books. You know, books out there. There's the Moore book that talks about the suck, swallow, breathe, postural, and those kinds of things around regulation. There's sensory integration theory and practice that talks about what sensory integration is. There's sensory integration in the child.
Perfect. Thank you all for the leads for our listeners, and you can also go to our website at klw.org to learn more. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Julia Wilbarger, Associate Professor of Occupational Therapy at Dominican University, Patty Otter, an occupational therapist and private consultant, Cassie Britton, a child development specialist at the Little School. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. Again, for a list of resources about sensory processing disorder, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join host Joseph Pache next Monday as we discuss The Last Mile, an exciting new tech program at San Quentin State Prison. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening to City Visions on KLW, your local public radio station. Good night and have a great week.